the week of November 12th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 388, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles at the Me Too March, I'm Michael Giltz.
Was there a Me Too March? I guess there was.
Yes, there was. There were a march on Saturday and a march on Sunday. Well, clearly, Sperling did not take part.
Well, Los Angeles is so big, you know, I didn't want to, you know, I hardly noticed.
I was stuck in traffic or I would have helped basic rights for women and men.
Well, I was stuck in traffic, probably caused by the march.
I wish it was that big. I'm not sure how big it was, but I assumed you would have read about it or seen it in the media, but I saw it on the Hollywood Reporter, so it didn't really break out beyond that.
Not that I know of.
Well, there you go. Well, with one tangible thing happening, and of course, we're going to be covering that this week, but what else are we going to talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll talk about The Fox and the Hound, or more specifically, how Disney is sniffing around Fox's assets. Disney had a poor quarter. Fox had a good quarter. So, of course, Fox is looking to unload its film studio and TV production. No wonder our portfolio is so weak. That makes no sense.
It makes no sense.
None whatsoever. But Disney laying off more ESPN employees, that we kind of get. In more Disney fun, we'll say a prayer for the ban that never was. During Book Filter, Michael will pitch a Sex and the City in the 1930s. On Inside Baseball, as we just alluded to, we must sadly continue to update you on the sexual harassment travails that have shaken up Hollywood, the media industry, and now politics, just when you think it couldn't get any worse and there is nobody left to point a finger at. It does, and there are. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. I have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, you name it, everybody. The Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, they're still covering box office despite Disney's protestations. And the number one movie around the world is Thor Ragnarok, $132 million on the weekend, $650 million worldwide. That's already more than the first two The first two Thor films. That is hard to say. So already they've passed it and they're still at $130 million on the weekend. So this one's going to barrel up to, I don't know, $800 million. Just depends what kind of legs it has. $900 million, who knows?
Well, think about it. They weren't planning on this being a $1 billion film. So nearly reaching that? I mean, that's not bad.
Well, when you spend $180 million on a movie, I'm sure you're thinking of $700, $800, $900 million. So a billion's always got to be in your mind. At number two, a little less expensive, is Murder on the Orient Express. This movie cost $55 million to make. It expanded wider this weekend. Its total now is $85 million worldwide. Had a pretty good opening here in North America, $28 million on the weekend. And since it's a film that appeals to older people, we figure they didn't all come out on the first day. So we can expect my mom to go next weekend or the weekend after that. So it might have pretty good legs. We'll have to wait and see.
My 11-year-old daughter saw a commercial for this film and said, oh, I really want to see that. Well, I want to read the book too, but I want to see it. And I thought,
Who are you?
Like, and then it dawned on me, wait, can she read Agatha Christie? Is that allowed? Like, is that inappropriate for me to give her an Agatha Christie book? But I don't
not
think
at
so.
All.
Yeah.
No, not at all. There's nothing remotely, you know, scandalous about it. I mean, it deals with murder and passion and things, but it's not adult or lurid in any sense.
Okay.
I think it would be fine. It depends on you and your 11-year-old, of course, but I wouldn't hesitate. I certainly wouldn't hesitate to show her the 1974 movie, would you? That's certainly not less explicit than the book.
I certainly cannot remember the 1974 movie.
Ah. Well, at number three, can you remember Daddy's Home? Because they've already got a sequel. Daddy's Home 2 opened this weekend at $30 million on the weekend. It cost about $70 million to make, but it's only in three territories. But comedies don't travel very well. But Mark Wahlberg is very popular, as is Will Ferrell. We'll have to see where it ends up. And number four is A Bad Mom's Christmas, $20 million on the weekend. And that franchise has hit $60 million worldwide. The horror flick Jigsaw made another $12 million on the weekend. That's at $80 million worldwide. And here's another film. Are there any original films? Paddington 2. This is, we don't know what it costs, but the first one cost $60 million. This is sort of the combo live action with a Paddington bear. It grossed $11 million on the weekend. I assume it opened up in the UK. You know, it's got a long way to go. The first one was quite popular. It will be released in North America in January. From the Weinstein Company. They're in a little bit of trouble, but maybe Harvey will feel kindly towards this movie. It's about a poor bear who's accused of something he didn't do.
Now, wait a second. Harvey has nothing to do with this anymore since he's no longer a...
but it's the name, but it's the company's name and all that. So it's one of the many assets they have to figure out. I think they've gone from trying to keep it afloat to just trying to selling it, haven't they?
Yes, they have.
That's a, yeah, it's a sad end for all the people who worked there and weren't complicit in whatever was going on. And number seven is Pixar's Coco. $8 million in the weekend. So that's at $41 million in Mexico alone. I couldn't quite figure out how that ranked among Mexican films over the years, their box office, but it's certainly a very strong showing, as you would expect, since it's set in Mexico. We'll have to see how it does in the rest of the world, but it's a very positive start from one territory. And number eight is Happy Death Day, the horror flick. That's at $90 million worldwide. And below that is the German comedy Suck Me, Shakespeare, Part 3. That's at $56 million worldwide. Gerard Butler is still fending off climate change and geostorm. That's just about to hit $200 million worldwide. So it's got a long ways to go before it triples its budget, which was about $120 million. We've got another new film here. It's The Brink. This is a Hong Kong action flick about a rebel cop played by Zhang Xin, who's trying to take down a gold smuggling ring who disguised themselves as fishermen. So if you look at the trailer, there's, you know, underwater action and gold bars at the bottom of the bay and bad guys and some really cool action stunts, actually. It opened up okay in Hong Kong or China. It's $6.4 million on the weekend. It is another horror film that's at $680 million worldwide. And below that, here's another new film. It's called 77 Days. It's sort of a kind of a Chinese Never Cry Wolf, if you remember that lovely film. This is an adventure film about a man who decides to cross some isolated tract of nature. And the trailer says people have always, adventurers and explorers have always gone vertically because it's shorter through this, you know, this very desolate region. But he's going to go horizontally. And he's going to try to do it within 80 days. It had a good weekend. It's at $7 million worldwide. And the trailer says you only have 30,000 days in your life. So I guess the question is, how are you going to spend them, Sperling?
Doing a podcast.
Will you spend one of them going through the wilds and risking your life and dealing with water buffalo and storms and things like that?
No, I'm going to spend them mostly trying to figure out whether $41 million in Mexico is a lot of money for Coco.
Yeah, I looked at some top films of the year in the Mexican box office. That's clearly not a record. I mean, it's just still going strong there. But it looks like it's a very promising, very strong showing for the movie. How it compares to other Pixar films, that would certainly be cool to know. If you're from Mexico or you're familiar with the Mexican box office and you know, let us know. How can they get in touch, Sperling?
Well, they can call or write us. You can write us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter at showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Now, Michael, you asked about Pixar movies. Finding Dory last year made $24.7 million at the box office in Mexico. The Jungle Book, not a Pixar film, but a Disney film, made $24.3 million. The Secret Wow. Life of Pets, $22.5 million. Captain America Civil War, $41.4 million last year. And this year, what is it? The Fate of the Furious, $36.3 million. So $41 million. For
it's a huge number.
Is a big number.
Very cool. Thanks for checking that up. By the way, Louis C.K. will not be in the next Secret Life of the Pets.
No.
Just
we'll explain
in case
why
you were wondering.
Later in the show.
Yeah. And, you know, again, if you know about, we learned about that box office, but if you've got any more figures, great. And if you know what this movie is, Perfect Couple, I don't know. It made $2 million on the weekend. I think it's being released in two Asian territories, but I'm not sure. I tried to figure out what it was, but it's such a vague title that I had no luck. So sometimes we really scratch our heads over some of these movies. And if you know, we'd love to hear from you. But there's a lot of movies once we got below 77 days that made about $2 million. Like, you know, Marry Me, Buddy, that French comedy, and The Bros, or whatever that movie is. That's another one that we're sort of lost in. Moving down for another new film, we see The Chinese Widow. This is a Chinese and English film. I don't know if it's a co-production, but their language spoken is both Chinese and English. It's set during World War II and directed by Billy August. It's about a pilot played by Emil Hirsch, who is bombing Tokyo and crash lands in China. And he ends up being hidden by a, of course, beautiful young widow. No, of course, they don't fall in love. That would be too obvious. No, no, no. They do fall in love, even though they don't speak each other's language. So that's opened up somewhere, and it made $1.8 million on the weekend. But at least we know what the movie is about. And that wraps up our box office for international. But if we look at North America, Lady Bird broke into the top 10 in North America, even though it's playing on just 37 screens. Sure, it's a slow week at the box office for the movies below the top three or four, but that's still great news. That's still a very strong showing for that movie. $1.2 million on the weekend. Clearly, this movie, I think, is going to be a player come the end of the year. You might see a nomination for Saoirse Ronan, since she's been nominated before, and an impressive film debut for Greta Gerwig. I'm sure critics will remember, even if Oscar doesn't. In contrast, I would say, is Three Billboards. That had a good weekend. It did well at the box office. Where were its numbers? Its numbers were, I just lost it for me. Oh, there we are. $80 million per screen on just four screens. However, the reviews have become decidedly mixed, I would say, starting with the New York Times. Everybody likes Frances McDormand, but I think the film itself is getting a lot more mixed reviews as sort of not quite there, even though they admired it.
You know, speaking of Oscar buzz for Lady Bird, I'm thinking Laurie Metcalf as the mother.
Oh, absolutely. No, she was terrific. And she's a very well-respected actress, nominated for one Emmys, one Tonys. No reason that she shouldn't be up for an Oscar.
Has she won Grammys? Because then you know.
Exactly. It's all I can think about. Yeah. The EGOT.
Yes.
I was frustrated by some stories that we saw in just about random stuff.
Just a few stories? I mean, I'm frustrated. I don't even look now about, you know, every time I see somebody's name trend on Twitter, I'm just like, oh, geez, what now?
Oh, I'm talking about coverage of the box office, not about sexual harassment and assault.
I know. I'm just saying, if you're just frustrated by a few stories in the entertainment press, I'm shocked.
Well, there were people saying, oh, God, I feel so bad. I admired Louis C.K. and I feel like a fool. You know, I was wrong. It's like, well, no, you know, you can only deal with the public art that they create. You don't, you know, thinking that you know what someone is like because of their art is always a bad road to take. You don't really know what people are like. And liking their art, to me, does not endorse who they are in private. You can perhaps get some new perspective on it and go, maybe what I thought he was saying, he didn't think he was saying, you know, or new perspective on Manhattan because of what, you know, happened in Woody Allen's private life or this, that, and yet clearly Louis C.K. But in general, I feel like, you know what? I still like Parsifal. I don't care what Wagner was like.
Right, exactly. And the question, well, we'll get into this later.
Yeah, but there were two stories, both from Variety. One was about Disney and Fox. They're getting ready to look at each other, and Fox is maybe going to sell some assets. And they said one reason, of course, is, quote, box office is hitting historic lows, end quote.
Right. Well, now, okay, here's the thing. And you're going to say, oh, Disney is down. Geez, you know, it's only one quarter. It's actually six quarters, at least for the network stuff, the ESPN and the its television assets have declined for six quarters. And yes, box office will rebound and be up in a year.
Is box office hitting historic lows? Is that an accurate statement? Is that an accurate statement of the North American box office or the worldwide box office for that matter, which is the ground that these companies play on? But even if you limit to North America, is it accurate to say overall box office is hitting historic lows?
I don't know whether adjusted for whether they're looking at adjusted for inflation.
No. Just in general.
In general, it's plateaued. It's flattened, absolutely. Is that a historic low?
Last year was the highest grossing year of all time. How is that a plateau and stagnant box office? So you listen to this show every week, and you think box office is, in fact, arguably hitting historic lows.
This year, I think there are segments of the year that hit historic
lows.
Would
that be winter, which was the highest grossing winter of all time?
No, I think...
Would it be spring, which was the fourth highest grossing spring of all time? Was it September, which was the highest grossing September of all time? Is that where you think... I mean, if you look at the year in total, which may well be the second highest grossing year of all time... Do you think it's fair to say because of June and July that box office in general is hitting historic lows and thus Fox should be selling off stuff?
I think they're looking, you know, forget about this year or next year. I think they're looking long term. I'm talking 10 years out.
I'm saying they're doing the opposite.
Oh, really?
Of course, okay. They're not. They're looking at it. They're reacting to what happened, you know, in June. They're not ignoring the fact that movies are now released 12 months a year. If they're looking long term like we do, you can see box office has kept pace with inflation and with population since the 1970s, that box office has steadily risen despite all the other claims on people's attention. Box office has not lost its share of the dollar. It's doing great. Worldwide is far bigger than ever. And there's all the honeypots of, you know, video on demand, Blu-ray, DVD, streaming, cable, satellite, premium cable, basic cable, and all that stuff. Movies are making more money than ever, exponentially more than they were in the 50s and 60s and 70s.
You know, every time I talk to a chief financial officer at a studio or a big production company like a Lakeshore Entertainment or any one of these companies that supply movies to the studios, they always are frustrated when they hear about, you know, somebody saying, oh, the movie didn't make money because it just broke even or barely broke right. even theatrically. They're like, don't you understand? That movie made a mint because, yes, we broke even theatrically or we came in just shy or just over. But in the end, the next 5 years, that movie just raked in money. Everything yeah. else was gravy.
Yeah, you just have to keep it in perspective and look at the total pay. When we talk about a movie being a hit, we just mean out of the gate.
Right. And you know, certainly being a hit out of the gate like a Thor will actually help it in downstream markets. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, certainly even a $40 million movie that like Murder on the Orient Express, okay, it's not going to be a huge, you know, blockbuster.
It's a $55 million movie.
$55 million movie. It made $28 million this week. It'll probably, if you triple that, it'll end up somewhere in the $70 to $80 million range. You know what? That's not bad when you think about it. Just in the U.S.
Well, yeah, it's grossing $85 million worldwide. It will likely get to $200 million. It'll be a financially successful film, even by the standards of just at the box office.
Right, but I mean, we're not talking about it like Thor. Oh my goodness, $800 million.
Well, no, that's why it costs $55 million to make instead of $180 million.
Correct.
That's why Lady Bird is a success, even though it cost whatever, $2 million, $3 million, $5 million. I mean, that's why you look at the budget. Of course, every film is unique.
So now, let me ask you this. The story that you're talking about, okay, that Variety had, was it a story about box office?
Who cares? It's Variety. They should always be accurate. It's a story, a profile of Christopher Nolan and the success of Dunkirk, and it was a profile about him. That was a profile. That was a big cover story on Christopher Nolan. The other one, box offices hitting historic lows, was a story about Disney and Fox.
Right, because basically what they're trying to point out here is the business is changing. Okay, and that's what they're
either
trying
box
to point
offices
out.
Hitting historic lows is accurate or it's not. I would, if as a fact checker, there is no way I would allow the sentence box offices hitting historic lows as a flat statement to pass. That is not accurate. That is simply not true. But you cannot say we're about to have the second highest grossing year of all time and say box office is hitting historic lows.
So, okay. So be the fact checker here and rewrite that sentence so that it makes sense. Given that advertising revenues are shrinking and box office is hitting historic lows, it makes sense that Fox would be feeling the heat. Okay. So given that sentence, how would you write that, hey, advertising revenues are shrinking, okay? And so, by the way, our licensing fees for, you know, retransmission, but that's beside the point.
And, are advertising revenues shrinking?
For certain pieces.
Right. For Fox overall, with their television and I guess the media is separate.
Correct.
But are we saying that that advertising is way down in TV? As far as I know, the networks and the box, I mean, Fox News is printing money left and right. Well, that's a different arm of
correct.
The business.
Correct.
But, you know, they have withstood the loss of Bill O'Reilly and Megyn Kelly, and they are still printing money. So I'm not sure where and how, if that is true. I would have to explore that to see if advertising really is down dramatically.
Okay, but putting that aside, how would you rewrite that hitting historic lows given that you had, you know,
June. That's like you saying, I don't know why they're selling the film studio. I would say the same thing. Film studio is a great business. they have been turning out movies. If they had a weak year, you have to take the long term. Why sell off your film studio because you had a poor year at the box office? Not every year is going to be, you know, stratospheric. But when you balance out a film and a TV production studio, if you don't have a hit here, you'll have a hit there. And, everybody balances each other out. And 2 years from now, suddenly Fox will be producing more hit films again. So I would say it's a puzzle. I would say with box office hitting record highs, one has to ask why Fox is loading off its film studio and the brand Fox, which is a value that you simply cannot replace.
Well,
I would say, why are they with box office in 2016 hitting record highs and 2017 looking set to be the second highest grossing year of all time and worldwide box office growing by leaps and bounds, which is the game Fox plays? My question is, why are you selling off your film studio? So I would say box office hitting historic highs. It's not lows, it's highs. And that's what happened last year. That's 2 minutes ago. Box office worldwide, again, year to year, is leaping and bounding to record highs over the last 10 years. And it's going to continue to do so this year. So to rewrite that sentence, I say, with box office hitting historic highs, one wonders why Fox is selling off their film and TV produced studios. That's how I would reword it, because that's accurate. It's wrong. It's inaccurate to say they're hitting historic lows. I can't believe we don't agree on that.
Well, now, if you're Disney, would you buy 20th Century Fox?
I don't know. It depends on what you get to keep and why. Are you going to sell off the land for the real estate? I mean, that's a business decision beyond my ken. Do they want another label like they used to have with Touchstone? In which case, why not redo Touchstone? Why do they need to buy Fox? But if you're buying the library, maybe that's buying the library and selling off the land. Maybe that alone makes it worthwhile.
I don't know. But so Fox is up earnings-wise. Disney, on the other hand, is down earnings-wise. Revenue declined 3%, and the company did not meet analysts' expectations, which I always find, who cares what analysts think other than the fact that for the short term, you get a stock hit.
Yeah, I mean, do you feel like Disney's in bad shape long term? I mean, we're narrowly focused on movies, obviously not, even though they had, the flop Cars 3 and Pirates of the Caribbean didn't do great. I mean, it made money, but it wasn't certainly a sterling achievement. But again, it's profitable commercially, that's for sure. So, all right. But a ESPN, ABC Network seems to be doing okay. I don't know. I'm not quite sure why why you would sell off stock.
Yeah, I think that I understand why people are a little nervous, and certainly analysts, stock analysts. ESPN has been driving their television assets, right? And if you look at it, ESPN, they continue to have tough quarters. In 2010, ESPN had 100 million subscribers, 100 million. They were in 100 million homes since nobody subscribes. They had cable subscribers paying, 100 million cable subscribers paying $4 a month to have access to ESPN. Now, 7 years later, they have 87 million homes, a 13% decline. So when you think about that, that's trending in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, by the way, ESPN is the gold standard. You're not making more money than on basic cable than ESPN.
Right. And that's why they're moving into the app, right? Because they see the writing on the wall in terms of that being able to still demand that amount of money.
Correct. Yes. Well, not only that, but they're seeing fewer and fewer people willing to pay for a basic cable package when they have to pay for 100 channels, some of which only cost 50 cents, some of which cost a dollar, some of which cost a nickel, and then ESPN, which costs $4, and all of these sports networks, none of which necessarily get watched by some people. People are cutting the cord. The cord cutting is actually coming true. Not quickly,
well, in the sense that they're not stopping to watch TV. They're just reducing the cost of their monthly payment by switching services.
Correct.
That's not cutting the cord in the way historically. They're just saying instead of cable, I want satellite. Or instead of cable and satellite, I want over the air, over the top.
Right. And so it's not necessarily they're cutting the cable cord, not the Ethernet cord.
They're saying you're charging us $150 a month and it's too damn much money.
Right.
And you're charging us, what is it? How many billions of dollars a year for just the DVR fee?
$20 billion a year.
$20 billion a year. They should just be accepting the fact that that is going to disappear within 10 years and behave accordingly. Would I buy Fox? I don't know. Would I buy Paramount? They just lost a $1 billion investment from China's Huahua Group. I'm sure I'm butchering that. But that was the company that said, we will back your slate for 3 years. We'll just give you a big chunk of change and we'll have a piece of everything. But they got cold feet. Management was unstable. Films started to flop like Transformers and Ghost in the Shell. Plus the government, the Chinese government said, hey, stop sending so much money overseas.
Right.
And so now they've lost that $1 billion investment, and Paramount says, that's great. We're thrilled because now we can do what we want.
Right. Here's the deal. I mean, ultimately what this was, it's slate financing. It's Legendary Entertainment paying for Warner Brothers films for, you know, 8 to 10 years, or now Universal's films. It's, hey, here's a chunk of money. You get to make films. We'll take 50% of it, or whatever the percentage is. We get, you know, a piece of every film. There's no cherry picking. We get Thor, we get, you know, over at Warner Brothers, it was Batman. They got a piece of everything. Mm-hmm. And so what Huahua Media was doing was going to do, they were slate financing, doing the same exact thing. I would say the biggest, you know, aspect of why they're not investing $1 billion, the biggest reason why not? The Chinese government. That's really what it is. The Chinese government came in and said, nobody send money overseas, especially for investments like media, which are shaky to begin with. And oh, by the way, Paramount, really? I mean, who's in charge over there? Sure, they have somebody in charge now, but how long is it going to take them to turn that around? And so, yeah, I would say I could see why the media group decided not to invest.
Well, you know, Disney is still sniffing around Fox, and meanwhile, they've caved pretty quickly. We were very upset with Disney for banning the LA Times from their film screenings and access to their stars to promote their films. And we were like, come on, why isn't everybody, you know, standing alongside the LA Times? Let's show some solidarity here. Well, that's exactly what happened, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. The very day we said, you know what should really happen is the Washington Post, the New York Times, LA Weekly, all these other journalists and other media outlets should say, well, if you're banning the LA Times, we're not covering you either during the home stretch of the year when it's kind of important to get some media. Not that, you know, they're going to hurt for it with Star Wars, but still, that's exactly what happened. And it wasn't just other media outlets. It was also film critics groups. So the Los Angeles Film Critics, New York Film Critics, National Society of Film Critics, I think Toronto and Boston also threw in their caps to say, you know what, we're taking your films out of the running.
Yeah, that's great news. The New York Times said if the LA Times people can't go to a screening, we won't go to a screening either. So good for everybody to do that. And Disney's response was, ban? What ban? There's no ban. And here's their snarky little comment. Quote, we've had productive discussions with the newly installed leadership at the LA Times regarding our specific concerns. And as a result, we've agreed to restore access to advanced screenings for their film critics. End quote. No, you should provide access to every legitimate major outlet. You've had zero actual complaints to make about the piece other than the fact that it exists. You should not have threatened a ban or done a ban in the first place. And you look weak for caving immediately, but we're glad you did because it was a stupid thing to have done.
And I really do not like that statement at all. If I was the LA Times, I'd say, yeah, I'm sorry. No, I would have come out with a statement after that to clarify that they have not threatened us. OK, that they have not, you know, bribed us in any way, because it makes it sound like, you know, yeah, we talked to them. You know what I mean? You know.
Oh, I thought it was more like, well, the people we didn't like are gone. So we're going to pretend that there's new people involved. So like those guys are gone. So our problem is with the, you know, we're fresh slate.
Right. But still, we've had productive discussions. You know what I mean? You know, discussions. That's all it was. You know, not with our brass knuckles or anything, but, you know, and I just thought, oh, geez, come on, really?
Yeah, no, it's and we've agreed to restore access. Excuse me. You want people to cover your movies? You got to let all the major outlets have access. You don't get to pick and choose based on who you're picked at, you know, peaked with over that week.
Well,
that should be a defining principle that all the outlets say, no, no, no. You don't give all of us, just like the Tony Awards. I didn't even put this in the notes. The Tony Awards have like 49 initial people that need to have access to all Tony shows if you want them to consider it for nominations and stuff. And one of them was blocked from the summer show 1984, the adaptation of the George Orwell musical, George Orwell novel. And so the Tony said, your show is not eligible and might well have been nominated for set design or some of the actors. Who knows? I doubt it, but it's possible. But because they blocked one of the critics because of producer Scott Rutan having a tiff with him, even though nobody will confirm that's what it is. You don't let them in, your show's not eligible. So suddenly all those people who worked in that show, unfortunately, are Tony ineligible because of them trying to block one critic. But they had to stand firm and say, you don't get to decide who comes to your show.
Well, certainly Disney has Star Wars The Last Jedi coming up, and they like this movie so much, they're giving Rian Johnson permission or the ability, or I don't even know what I'm saying. He's going to direct a trilogy or oversee a trilogy of Star Wars films, a spin-off series.
That's right. Instead of doing a one-off, they're going to say, we're doing a new trilogy. It's not part of the Luke, Leia, and the kids that we're dealing with today. It's a whole new thing and another part of Star Wars, but it will be a trilogy, you know, with a long arc to it. He's going to write and direct one of them, the first one, and oversee the rest. Who knows what he'll do? But yeah, it's completely separate, a new thing. It's a big trilogy. It's their next big trilogy. So, you know, they're not saying a Han Solo trilogy. They're not saying a clearly not a Rogue One trilogy, but yeah. They're saying this week in reboots and spinoffs, we're going to do another Star Wars trilogy. Don't worry, we'll still keep making lots of trilogies. They also announced some stuff for their streaming service. They said, we're going to do a TV series spinoff of Monsters, Inc., some Marvel property to be named later, sounds like baseball, and High School Musical, the TV series. All of that will be available only on their streaming service, which makes me feel like, what the heck's wrong with broadcast?
Well,
you know, seriously.
When you look at what CBS did with Star Trek, it was incredibly successful.
We have no idea how many people have signed up for the CBS service. We don't know how successful it is. They're not telling us.
I thought they said close to 12 million people, but you know, that said,
when did they say that? I didn't see that. They just said we were very happy with the people who've signed up. They've announced that 12 million people have signed up to the CBS service. I missed that.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and double check too, and let's not do that while we're recording. That said, it seems to the industry is looking at it going, okay, this has been somewhat successful. How successful? Okay, maybe arguable. And certainly I would fully expect that Disney to do this.
Well, I feel cheated because, people, you know, they've just lowered their cable bill and you're like, oh, you're going to pay for a Disney Channel and a CBS and then obviously ultimately an NBC and a ABC, you know, ABC. I don't know if that makes sense, but, you know, 47 different, paid little services to get movies and TV shows. That becomes untenable too. There's going to be a lot of losers. You've got a platform where you can reach everybody on ABC. And I imagine ABC still makes a lot of money for you I'm just not sure about the balance here.
Well, I do know that this is probably one of the reasons why Disney would buy Fox for the library for its streaming service.
That's true, because they don't have a deep library in terms of that necessarily from the old days, and it certainly would be a huge addition to get the Fox library.
Correct.
That's right. Well, CW, they're extending a full season order to the Dynasty reboot. So that's it. But yeah, you know, I'm a fan of sci-fi. I would love to watch the Star Trek. I'd love to watch the, whatever they're doing, on this. They've got a live action series, but I forgot that one, that, you know, Star Wars trilogy. They've also doing a live action Star Wars TV series for their streaming service. So Monsters, Inc., Marvel, High School Musical, and a live action Star Wars series, all on the app only, all on their standalone service. That's like, those are the biggest things you can do all on your app. So if I love Star Wars and Star Trek, now I've got two more monthly bills to pay. $5 or $7 or $8 for CBS and Disney. That adds up awfully fast.
Well, you did ask me, from Deadline, Anthony D'Alessandro writing that Star Trek Discovery fuels record signups for CBS All Access. That's the
record, but they didn't say what. I want numbers. That's the whole point. They said record. Well, record compared to what? You launched a week ago. That's like the magazine that says we're the fastest growing magazine in America. We've gone from 1 to 7 subscribers.
Yeah, true.
If we don't have numbers, it's meaningless. But we do have numbers on the Lord of the Rings TV series, and that number is at least 2 seasons. A multi-season commitment from Amazon has landed them the Lord of the Rings TV series. Whether it's going to be retelling of the film or some other story in Middle Earth or how they're going to deal with this, I don't know. But Amazon was looking for big, you know, swings at the fences. Well, they got it. Lord of the Rings is at Amazon, and they will be committing to at least a 2-season run.
And I was wrong, by the way. It wasn't 12 million. It was 4 million subscribers by the end of 2017, according
to... That was what they were... That's their goal.
Right, and they're on track to surpass that.
They're on track, but give us the numbers. Yeah. And we were right about Paddington Bear too. The Weinstein Company is trying to sell it off before they declare bankruptcy or whatever they're doing next. So they're trying to say, hey, this has got some value. Let's get the most value out of it that we can. And they're saying, hey, Disney, who wants a bear? Anybody want a bear?
It's a teddy bear.
It's a teddy bear. He's very cute.
Pick it up in Paddington Station.
Yeah.
Well, that that wasn't even a segment. It's just kind of like our box office movie. It's our kind of everything segment. But it moves us along into Book Filter. Every week, Michael dives into the new book releases and brings us a book that's ready for its close-up, if you will. What have you got for us this week, Michael?
Well, I've got two books. One is not necessarily a property to develop, but it's one that's of interest, I think, to our listeners. It's got trademark, copyright infringement, the rights of employees, and it's called You Don't Own Me by Orly Lobel, and it's the story of the legal battle between Mattel and Hasbro over Barbie and Bratz. This is the story we've talked about before, where a Mattel employee came up with the idea of Bratz on his off hours, and he sold it to Hasbro. And Mattel said, hey, not so fast. And he's like, you don't own me. And, you know, a big battle ensued. And Bratz was one of the few dolls to ever even challenge Barbie for, you know, top sales in a year. So, you know, it's become a huge property. They sort of symbolize different approaches to womanhood and how they define it and how they influence kids. It's just a fun, geeky story that makes trademark and copyright kind of interesting, which isn't easy to do. But my pick of the week, the book that I think should be developed maybe into a TV series, is The Extra Woman by Joanna Scutts. And this is a bio of Marjorie Hillis. This is a woman who was really famous back in the 1930s. She worked at Vogue and she was single. And she published a book called Live Alone and Like It, A Guide for the Extra Woman. It was just a huge phenomenon. And she was saying basically the single gal is okay. You're not a spinster. You're not an old maid. You're independent and you can be happy. And she wrote columns about it in the book. It really became a phenomenon. She talked about the joys of breakfast in bed alone and, you know, living a desirable life and how being single does not mean you're a loser and you're missing something. But in fact, it's a thing to celebrate all on its own. And she was really a big media star. It's changed the way how women were seen, especially women who were single, sort of an early wave of feminism, the between the first wave of the suffragettes and the second wave of the 60s and 70s, there was Marjorie Hillis in the 30s championing women. And to me, it sounds exactly like Sex and the City. You know, single gal promoting her life, talking about it, sharing it, writing a hip book in the pages of Vogue. I think it'd be an awesome thing to do for the 1930s.
So you're saying Marjorie Hillis was a big deal back in the 1930s?
Absolutely.
That means it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment, where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, how could it not be our first story? It ain't easy staying on top of the ever-changing social media landscape, but pop star Taylor Swift is poised to sell at least 1 million physical copies of her new album, Reputation, this week, making it her fourth straight record to see at least 1 million copies in its first week. Like Adele, Swift will be holding off on making the music available via streaming services. Lead single Look What You Made Me Do hit number one and got tons of video play, but was no monster smash like Shake It Off. A second hit number four, and a third number 13, with a fourth due the same week the album comes out. Swift connects with fans via Tumblr a lot, which is seen as a space easier to control the back and forth of artists and fans. When a blogger said Swift was in danger of being co-opted by hate groups on the far right, instead of denouncing those groups, lawyers for Swift sent the writer a letter threatening to sue. Golly, can't a girl just release a smash hit album, tour, and rake in the love? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, you can see all the weird, crazy challenges you face when you're that big a star. The singles are not doing as great as the last one. It's sure to sell a lot of copies out the gate. It got a good review in Rolling Stone, and she'll be replacing the number one album this week, which is Sam Smith's The Thrill of It All. That's his first number one album, I think. And he sold a couple hundred thousand copies, or its equivalent in streaming. She's going to sell actual physical copies, doing it old school. So that's kind of fun to see.
It's pretty remarkable because that does not happen in Wesson. Unbelievable number of albums to sell in 1 week.
Yeah, anybody to do it for a year is going to be really happy.
Right. Well, and, you know, how many weeks was she on top last album?
I forget.
But there's just something about, like, she's like kind of morphed into something that is, I don't know. It's just, I know it's different, and you know, certainly I'm not trying to pigeonhole her, but she's so trying to distance herself from, you know, the country girl that she started out as, that she won a country music award for writing a song that I can't even remember who. I think Big Little, I can't remember who sang it, but she didn't even show up at the Country Music Awards. She just kind of, you know, said, you
well,
know,
I mean, it was probably bad timing because of the new album. Though, of course, you could promote it on the Country Music Awards, but it wouldn't fit.
Right. And so she was like, you know, I don't want to be seen there. Now, I'm not saying this was what she said, but look, her team knows when the Country Music Awards is. She easily could have gone if she wanted to. Mm-hmm. Now, have you met Miss Jones? Vanity Fair is announcing its new editor, and it's Radhika Jones of the New York Times. She's currently the newspaper's book editor and is very well known in literary circles, naturally. Previously, she worked at Time Magazine and oversaw the Time 100 issues, which meant covering people from every walk of life. Nonetheless, she has few contacts in Hollywood, which is usually job one at Vanity Fair. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, right? It's one of the last mainstays of print publication, Vanity Fair, and it's as coveted a slot as you can get. So that's very cool for her. We'll have to see how she does. I guess it means I could apply for the job at the New York Times, right?
You probably could, actually.
Yeah, so it'll be cool to see. I mean, are they going to make book reading cool again at Vanity Fair? They're going to have more authors in the mix. That'll be neat. That'll be fun.
Yeah, certainly Graydon Carter had a lot of Hollywood connections, but I would say that once you take over a position like the editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair, you almost have kind of entree to meet the contacts that you would need.
Exactly. I remember once I was 100 years ago, I was up for some job at Hollywood Reporter. I'm like, well, now, what are your contacts in the movie industry? And I'm like, well, if I'm at Hollywood Reporter and I call, I'm guessing they'll take my, you know, it's like, what do you mean? Like, it's like, not, you know, I don't mean the head of the studios, but I'm thinking, well, won't be at the Hollywood Reporter. Won't that mean, you know, hey, your call will be answered by the appropriate people?
Yes, I would agree. And then there was one in a story that should have absolutely no antitrust implications. The toy maker Hasbro is making a bid to take over its main rival, Mattel.
And then they'll kill Bratz. Oh, I'm sorry. It's the other way around. They'll kill Barbie.
That's only fair. Two decades ago, Mattel tried to take over Hasbro. Now Hasbro is valued at more than $11 billion, and Mattel's stock has fallen 50% in the last year, and it's valued at $5 billion. This comes on top of the retail chain Toys R Us declaring bankruptcy in September, another blow to the toy industry and physical retail sales. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, gosh, it's hard to imagine how that could pass antitrust implications, but that's not the world we live in right now, is it? But it is a good time for us to announce that we will be doing a hostile takeover of NPR.
That is correct.
We should not have, I guess this stuff is already in play, so announcing it here, it's all right. It's already happening now, they know.
Yes, we're in our quiet period right now.
That's right.
Consumers seemed to dump audio cassettes for good in the 1990s. They wanted shiny compact discs. Then came digital downloads to supplant the shiny compact discs. And what happens? Suddenly there's a market for vinyl and audio cassettes again. And the U.S. National Audio Company is the only company that still makes cassettes, a format that artists have embraced again for its DIY retro appeal. They send them out to tastemakers and sell them to fans at shows who go, what am I supposed to play this on? But the actual audio tape, the stuff the music is copied onto, that's running out. National Audio has been buying up the stock as manufacturers go out of business. But as demand rises and supply falls, they are down to less than a year's worth of stock. So they're building a factory to make more and promise the audio quality will be better than ever. You'll hardly ever hear the hiss now. They've got a plant in Springfield, Missouri going online, and by January, they hope to churn out 4 million miles of tape per minute. Why would anybody need that much tape anyway? So everyone, from Metallica to your favorite indie band, can relax. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, right? I mean, vinyl is proving a, you know, $100 million plus little format. That's real money in the book, in the music industry. So, you know, if they can turn audio cassettes back into a format that sells enough to make that kind of coin, that's pretty good. It's still nowhere near what digital is, but it's fun to see.
You know, back, I want to say 3 or 4 years ago, I backed a project on Kickstarter that was making a documentary about the return of cassette tapes, about what happened to them and about how they were making a return. This was 4 years ago. I have yet to see the movie. I have yet to, like, you know, it was one of those Kickstarter campaigns where I get like an update every now and again, and they're like, yeah, we're editing still. And I'm like, what are you editing on videotape? You're like, come on. The merger that shouldn't happen probably still will. However, the media mashup of AT&T and Time Warner is a little more uncertain, with the Justice Department eyeing the deal closely and considering a lawsuit to stop or amend it substantially. During his presidential campaign, Donald Trump said he opposed the merger because CNN was fake news. CNN is owned by Time Warner. And by the way, there was just too much media consolidation. That's what he said at the time. It may be the one campaign promise Donald Trump keeps, though, of course, the decision on it should be shielded from politics. AT&T says they have never suggested they would sell off CNN to make sure the deal happens, and they certainly will not, even though that's what's supposedly being floated now by the Justice Department. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, right? Whether this merger happens or not, it's going to have a lot of ramifications. And certainly CNN, that's responsible for $1 billion in profit. That's like a quarter of Time Warner's $4 billion. So, you know, that's a big chunk of where they make money, just like Fox News really churns it out for Fox. So, yeah, why the hell would they sell it?
Yeah, and based on the way that Trump has gone after CNN, both, you know, verbally and, in you know, with his tweets, I think that AT&T and Time Warner would have a legitimate lawsuit on their hands if the Justice Department sued to block it unless CNN was sold.
Right. Though, I mean, years of, you know, delays and getting through the courts and, you know, you having business on hold while you wait to find out what happens with the lawsuit is also untenable. So, you know, it's not a very satisfying thing to resort to.
That I agree with. Yeah. It's good to be the king. Drake is the king of pop music right now. He saw a UK show called Top Boy that was canceled too soon after just two seasons, decided he wanted to see more, and got Netflix to order up 10 episodes via his production company. That's actually kind of nice. You know, you like a show and you kind of...
Like Drake, get us new Deadwood. Get Firefly again. You know, like, that'd be awesome if you could bring back all your favorite TV shows.
Exactly. Become famous just so you could bring back your famous TV shows. So Apple has so much money, they don't know what to do with it.
Podcasts, invest in podcasts, podcasts, entertainment podcasts.
I agree with Michael. Anyway, they said, we love Jennifer Aniston. Everyone loves Jennifer Aniston. Why isn't she doing a TV show? So now she is. Apple announced two new scripted series. One is the revival of Steven Spielberg's anthology series, Amazing Stories. Brian Fuller is also on board because he's not busy enough either. The other is a drama about the morning news show wars, and it stars Aniston and Reese Witherspoon. Both are going straight to series, and the Aniston project has a two-season order. Big deal or big whoop?
It's just news about stuff happening. It's kind of cool and interesting if you're interested in those projects. I'd love to know what Apple's plan is, though. How will the shows be available? Are they available via subscription, presumably through iTunes or maybe another platform? Will there be some advertising? Will they be dumped one episode at a time or all at once? We still don't know a lot about what's happening. And where's that Dr. Dre series? Yeah. Is it awful or just waiting to drop it?
I don't know, but I have a feeling you're right about that. There is some question about this. You know, there's some question about whether Apple knows what it's doing in the TV space at all in the first place.
Well, they've got a couple $1 billion to try and fail before they worry about it.
Ever sung along with the radio, Michael?
I have.
Well, then there's an app for that, and it's worth a lot of money. The Chinese app
I'm much too good at goodbye.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. There's a Chinese app dubbed Musical.ly. That's musical.ly. It was launched 3 years ago by two 30-something co-CEOs because if you're in your 40s, you're not launching an app.
You're dead.
Yes. They were tapping into the phenomenon of tweens and teens sharing video selfies where they sang and danced to popular music. These quote-unquote musers, as they're called, of course, develop fans, sometimes tens of millions of fans, though it seems more karaoke than discovering the next Charlie Puth. Now the Shanghai-based app even has an office in Santa Monica, some 60...
Why?
Well, because I think that they were trying to break into the American market, even though they didn't necessarily need to. Some 60 million monthly users, and has been snapped up by a Chinese media company for $800 million, and what could ultimately be a $1 billion deal when all is said and done. Big deal or big whoop?
Let's create an app.
Yeah, we're in the wrong business.
Tell me something I don't know.
Now, Australian TV is hitting new highs in terms of money spent and the number of hours of original content being created. Maybe they can create some for Apple. According to a government body, a record $250 million was spent on creating 46 TV shows and 457 hours of programming. Dramas like Picnic at Hanging Rock and Wentworth were joined by sitcoms like The Family Law and Here Comes the Babibs, or Babibs. I don't know. Anyway, the lone category to fall was kids programming. Overall, film and TV production hit just about $1 billion, including foreign films and TV shows that contributed about half to that total. Overseas film production in Australia hit a record high, as did the amount of money spent on Australian movies. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Great to see a healthy local market. That's good for them. And it's good for us because it creates new shows that other people can pick up. I didn't realize that The Good Doctor, this big, massive hit on CBS, that which is pacing ahead of This Is Us, how they were doing last year, it's a remake of a hit Korean drama.
Yes, it is.
I had missed that detail and was shopped around by Daniel Dae Kim of Hawaii Five-0, who took it to CBS and they said, oh, no thanks. Whoops.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't know. I watched about four episodes of it because my oldest daughter loves it.
Right.
I don't know. I don't get it.
Well, it's not, every show's not for everyone.
Or as the main character would say, I don't know. I don't get it.
Okay. That's a failure.
The joke or the show?
No, neither. So, sexual harassment is certainly I don't get it either. People are so freaked out. They're like, oh my God, what's going to happen? We're going too far. It's, what if I can't date coworkers? Well, you'll survive.
Well, that must mean we're talking about some inside baseball. Inside Baseball is our segment where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And here's how these stories will affect you guys out there who are listening to us. You're going to have to hear about them, it seems like, forever. And maybe that's a bad thing. Maybe that's not a bad thing. Certainly, hopefully, sexual harassment, we all want to end. So we hope that the stories will end.
Well, that's just putting the cart before the horse. We're happy the stories are there so that something that's been going on for centuries can finally maybe start to change. And the dummy of the week, I think, is Gay Talese. Gay Talese, who had his final book, famed investigative journalist, his final book blew up in his face because of some really fundamental failures on his part as a journalist. And for some reason, he was at some public event, and he was sort of mocking Anthony Rapp, who came up and talked about what Kevin Spacey had attempted with him. And he was basically telling Anthony Rapp, oh, suck it up. He said, come on, it happened 40 years ago. And you just feel like, yeah, you're old.
Wait a second. So here's a question. What was his final book? The one about him, the guy in the voyeur. Yeah. Okay.
There was a documentary at the New York Film Festival about that. It was about a voyeur, a guy who in a hotel spied on his guests for decades. The guy claimed to have seen a murder. But he had detailed diaries of the people that he spied on and what he saw, as banal as, them just eating dinner or having sex or arguing. He had them for 3 years. He had them for decades, but he had them for 3 years specifically before he'd even owned it. So he didn't own the place and he wasn't working there. And he had a detailed diary of every night, which kind of calls into question the rest of the diary, doesn't it? He claimed to see a murder, but in fact, no murder took place there, nowhere near. So it's not true. So, when you got someone who's an inveterate liar, the book blew up in his face.
Okay.
And he kind of can't deal with that. And he has, it shows him sort of,
Is that why you're saying it's his last book?
Well, his most recent book, but he's also,
he's in his
80s and yeah. He doesn't have much more in him, I don't think. But this clearly, I think, took the wind out of his sails. This man at the end of his career, this was going to be the crowning final achievement excerpted in the New Yorker, and the whole thing blew up in his face. And when you read what happens and how and why, you just think, well, that was, you messed up.
Well, speaking of messing up, I would say, where do you start? This week, Kevin Spacey must be thanking Louis C.K. because, I mean, Kevin Spacey, whether you believe Anthony Rapp or not, okay, which we all do.
There's multiple people, so there's no question.
Right,
I don't
exactly.
Think we need to talk about it. And we do believe Anthony Rapp.
Right.
People get angry that, well, you're just believing them because they're famous and they're white. It's like, well, they do have the luxury of being able to speak out. And be able to afford any lawsuits that might have occurred. But yes, it's true. When you're famous and you have nothing whatsoever to gain, it gives you an extra credit. But what the heck? Why the heck would Anthony Rapp make this up? He's on a TV show. He's on a hit TV show. He's wealthy. He's well-known on Broadway. The guy's, got no reason whatsoever to make it up. And that does, of course, make you think, well, And then other people come forward and you say, well, now there's no question. When you have multiple people and decades-long abuse of his power, at the very least, you know, yeah, of course we believe him.
Well, Mr. Spacey is in an upcoming film that Ridley Scott directed called All the Money in the World. It was supposed to close the AFI Film Festival here in Los Angeles. He plays J. Paul Getty in, it's a kind of a true story of the kidnapping of J. Paul Getty's, it was a granddaughter or grandson?
I forget.
Yeah, I forget as well. It's a true story. And he was playing J. Paul Getty and had to, you know, the old people makeup, as they say. Well, guess what? Just weeks before, he's got 4 weeks to redo this, Ridley Scott is going to replace Kevin Spacey in the film with actor Christopher Plummer. All of his scenes are being reshot and reinserted into the movie. You want to talk about a feat. If that can happen in just 6 weeks, I will be shocked. I will be amazed. It probably can because they can throw money at it.
Of course it can,
yeah. But it's going to be a sprint.
It certainly will. It's kind of amazing. It's just a technical achievement. It's just amazing that it's happened and will happen. So other people have died in the middle of shooting. Other people have fallen out for some reason. But this is fairly unprecedented to have an entire film shot and done and then to replace a character like that. And for this reason, it's kind of amazing.
I mean, think about all of the logistics of color timing, remixing audio, striking DCPs and prints, the physical distribution of those. It's a huge task.
And digital helps that, doesn't it?
It does, but you still have to do it.
But I mean, you don't have to, if you have to create 800 prints, that could be a real problem.
Correct.
So that's a helpful. But this is a week where you have U.S. senators, female senators, on the morning news shows talking about Me Too and about their dealings with sexual harassment and assault. In the U.K., a cabinet minister has stepped down. Dozens of legislators face stories. We've got stories in the Times about state houses. It's far beyond Hollywood, but this is where we know the most. And the latest on Harvey Weinstein. The Weinstein Company has a debt load of over $500 million, say some outsiders, making even a sale difficult. Forget a lifeline anymore. I have to apologize to Ronan Farrow. I thought, New Yorker, why are they having Ronan Farrow do a year-long investigation? He's never done anything. Well, he did a second article following up talking about the dirty tricks of Harvey Weinstein's lawyers, and it's kind of jaw-dropping. I mean, full credit to him for getting that story. He hired lawyer David Boies, of course, who also repped the New York Times. So the David Boies company was repping the New York Times and a man who was trying to kill a New York Times story and get dirt on New York Times reporters, to which David Boies says, conflict? What conflict? There was no conflict. If that's not bad enough, they hired former Mossad agents to befriend Rose McGowan, pretend to be a woman's advocate, and try and cozy up to her, get information from her, saying, I want to work with you. They gave interviews to journalists to pump them for information and dig up dirt on the journalists and track down leads to who else they were talking to. I mean, if you think you're the ex-wife of Richard Rodriguez was contacted by them to dig up dirt, I mean, if you think you're paranoid before, that really has to blow your mind. A woman contacting you from a woman's group saying, oh, we're here to support you, we'll work with you, or telling their own tearful story, and you find out they're a former Mossad agent hired by Harvey Weinstein. Oh, my God.
I see a movie.
Exactly. That's unbelievable. But Louis C.K. is the big one here this week, isn't it? Wow. Tell us about that complete collapse of a career in about 7 days.
Well, certainly, you know, a lot of people within the industry had always kind of, you know, there's always rumors.
Again, not me. I had no idea.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, people say this, but like, no, I didn't know Louis Case that kept exposing himself to women and asking if he could masturbate in front of them. I had no idea.
Well, starting in September, around the time of the Toronto Film Festival, Tig Notaro, who is a comedian who Louis C.K. helped kind of, you know, launch her career.
He helped champion her.
She started distancing herself from him, and there was a lot of questions to, wait, what's going on here? Are all these stories we hear true? And then there was a New York Times story on Louis C.K.'s sexual harassment, where with 5 women coming forward with stories of sexual misconduct, he invited these comics to hotel rooms back in 2002, where he would basically start masturbating in front of them.
He did it on a phone with executives and other people. Courtney Cox was involved in a TV show where he propositioned a woman on the set, and she said it was terrible. She was quoted saying how bad it was, and you know, and they called him out on it at the time. But you know, it's a widespread. And again, all these stories, let's remember, a lot of them have started from good old-fashioned investigative journalism. People talk about social media and this and that and crying wolf. No, this is about journalists doing their job, talking to people, talking to their friends and associates who can confirm that they were saying these stories at the time, talking to other people to see if there's a pattern, looking for lawsuits and things like that and legal settlements. This is good old-fashioned journalism exposing this stuff.
And what I would point out, you said something very important right there. Talking to other people, seeing if there's a pattern. They're not talking to one person and kind of saying, okay, you told your mother? Okay, let me talk to your mother. Okay.
Rolling Stone. That is the thing that Rolling Stone, who has done a lot of great journalism, dropped the ball on. They did a single source anonymous person
right. Condemning
a fraternity. You know, again, as a former fact checker, like how the hell did that get through there? So great job for all these people doing their work.
Right. So when you have like 20 people coming forward saying, yeah, that guy, absolutely, here's what happened, and separately saying the same exact story, guess what? It's probably true. But this is the problem, not the problem, but this is an issue for the people who work on all of these productions, whether it's a television show at FX that Louis C.K. was either starring in or producing, or his managers and agents, 3 Arts. Now, mind you, they all have other clients. They'll be fine. But what about the distributor of I Love You, Daddy, which is a film that Louis C.K. directed, and they picked it up at Toronto and the Orchard. It's a small distributor. They had a lot riding on this because they had a lot invested into it. They had to cancel the premiere of the film the night of the premiere.
They've canceled the film release, period.
Yes. And yeah, so Netflix is canceling stand-up specials that featured Louis C.K., much like, I guess Kevin Spacey was in a Gore Vidal picture that they had to cancel. These films are done. What is the director who made that film now going to do? What is he,
That's true. When people abuse their power, innocent people pay a price. And that's a shame, but that's what's happening.
Correct.
Yeah. So all of his projects have collapsed. All of his upcoming stuff has collapsed for the moment. Everybody has cut ties with him. His manager, his publicist, his agent, FX, his longtime home. HBO projects have been removed from HBO on demand as if he's the pharaoh, the former pharaoh, and you want to erase all mention of their names from history. It's kind of creepy in a way. Like, who cares if his old projects are on HBO on demand? I don't understand that. It's like you're trying to pretend they never existed. I actually find that a little creepy. If people want to watch it again and say, how does this play now that I guess they're worried that you'll say, well, they're profiting from, interest in the other. Well, so what? Stop pretending it didn't exist. Let's not get creepy here. And he put out a confession, right?
Yes.
Some people found it not enough at all. I didn't parse it quite that way. But a fair number of people said, no, he's hedging his bet. I thought it was a fairly complete. And not like he's done and we're all happy again, but it seemed to be a full accepting of responsibility. I was a bad person. I need to learn and listen. I need help, blah, blah, blah. At least he's saying you're all true. Everything they said is true and I'm a bad person. So that's a hell of a lot better than saying they're lying and I'm going to sue. It doesn't exonerate him, of course, by any stretch, but wow, how quickly a life can collapse.
Well, and here's the thing. In 2002 is when, the first people, there were these two comedians at the Aspen Comedy Festival in 2002. They told the owner of the Improv in Los Angeles. Improv is like a small little bar that, has a brick wall behind the performers. You've seen it if you've seen these stand-up specials. There's like 300 people in the room, if that. And a friend convinced me to go see this comedian, Louis C.K. I had no idea who this guy was. And it was 2006 in February. And I was told, oh, he's this guy who writes for the Chris Rock show. He used to be the head writer on the Chris Rock. I said, okay, whatever. And he was the main performer that night. And I thought, wow, he is really funny. And of course, from there, a year or two or three later, he started to become more and more and more successful. But in 2002, he was successful enough that these comedians would come back to his hotel room. I didn't even know who he was in 2002. Those two comedians told the owner of the Improv, and yet the Improv still booked him.
Yeah. Well, that's a different era. Hopefully that won't happen again. It's certainly a different era for producer Gary Goddard. Actor Anthony Edwards of ER says his one-time manager and mentor, Gary Goddard, molested him when he was 12 years old, raped his friend, and they stayed quiet for years. Goddard, of course, was one of the people sued by that actor who's talked about those house parties involving the pedophiles who had to flee the country, and a lot of big names in Hollywood where the guys were barely of age to the point where they had to check their IDs at the door. Well, this was one of the people accused by that actor that people sort of said, ah, he's a liar. And here's Anthony Edwards again, like Anthony Rapp. What possible reason could he have for making this up? As of yet, we have not heard other people come forward except for that guy from the past. But, that raises up the issue where you have just one person forward so far. It's not that you want to disbelieve anyone. And of course, innocent until proven guilty, that's for the court of law, not the court of public opinion, as Mitt Romney said about Judge Roy Moore. But, you want to pause before a single accusation by anyone, however credible, lets you form in your mind how you think about it. So you've got Matthew Weiner being accused by a writer of sexual harassment and dumping her talents. You've got Jeffrey Tambor, who's faced an accusation by transgender activist and star Van Barnes. She said he did inappropriate content. You've got George Takei, one of the more upsetting ones, because he's been such a good positive figure for gay people for years now. This actor says he sort of pulled a Bill Cosby, says he drugged and assaulted him at his home, said they were friends for years. Takei adamantly denies it, says he's not even sure if he knows who this guy is. The guy says they were friends. Again, it's not fair of us maybe to say, I don't say we don't believe you, but we're going to feel a lot better in a weird way if like five other people come forward and you see a pattern and whatever. So when you're dealing with all these things, we're not even close to a Salem Rich trial atmosphere here. A lot of these people are, a huge pattern, a lot of people coming forward, and that's where we feel comfortable weighing in.
So here's the problem that I have with the George Takei issue. And I'm not saying I have a problem with George Takei or Matthew Weiner, who was the creator of Mad Men. It's that they talk to one person who says this event happened, and then they talk to people that person supposedly told at the time.
Right, which they did.
Right, but, to me, I agree with you. If it's what the New York Times is doing, what the Washington Post is doing, and what the New Yorker did in its latest piece by Ronan Farrow, that is investigative journalism.
They made sure this guy was around at the time. They made sure that he was there. They are doing the efforts to make sure that was that person in that location at that time. I mean, this is not bad journalism necessarily. They have done the steps. One person needs to come forward. You can't always find 20 people to come forward right away. When one person comes forward, like Anthony Rapp, then other people come forward, perhaps. So I'm not questioning the journalism done here. I'm just saying this is a first step before we say, burn all copies of Mad Men. You're kind of, in a weird way, hoping that more people come forward so you can see a pattern. But I don't think this is sloppy journalism. From what I read of the George Takei piece, they did speak to his friends at the time. They made sure they were in the same city at the time. They did an effort to make sure that it checked out to whatever degree they could.
Right. Well,
so we'll have to see. But Ed Westwick of Gossip Girl, two women have alleged him. One woman came forward and said he raped her. He angrily denied it, of course. And then another woman has come forward now and says he raped her. And his roommate at the time was Mark Salling of Glee. Mark Salling, who, of course, has pled guilty to hoarding a treasure trove of kiddie porn, 500,000 plus images. Good heavens. So Ed Westwick is already paying a price. The BBC has yanked a show that was going to be part of their Christmas Day roundup, and they stopped filming on season two of a show he stars in called White Gold. So two women have come forward accusing him of rape, and it only happened because one woman came forward and they reported on it in, I think, what was a fairly, reasonable standard. You can't launch a 10-month investigation of everybody. You shouldn't just willy-nilly print any accusation by anyone. But if you determine they were there, they were around, they told other people at the time, they can offer them to you, I think that's responsible. I'm not sure which story you take issue with, but if there's a case of bad journalism, absolutely, we should condemn that.
The Takei one and the Matt Weiner one are two where I'm like, these are ones where, I don't know.
Well, the Matt Weiner woman is, of course, open, and Cater Gordon, she's an Emmy winner. She didn't keep her name secret. But if you're wondering whether there's enough there, I can understand that. I'm not saying you have to condemn Matt Weiner, but yeah, you always want more, of course, because right. It is the sort of thing, not a lot of people run around making false accusations. We know that's true. However, once you've accused someone of it, their life is tarred and feathered with that forever, no matter what happens, unless there's some bizarre, complete admission of lies. So, yeah, you hate to rush to judgment. But clearly there's a lot of judgment to be rushing to. You know, 19 people coming forward to condemn Andrew Kreisberg, a producer on Supergirl and Arrow and all these different shows. Years of sexual harassment, kissing them when they didn't want to be kissed, inappropriate touching, asking women to massage him. I mean, not just women. 15 women and 4 men have come forward. Richard Dreyfuss, a week ago, his son is complaining that Kevin Spacey hit on him when Richard Dreyfuss was in the room. And now he's being accused of compulsively hitting on women. And he basically said, I was a jerk. I don't know what I did with this woman. No, I thought we were friends. And that seems more of a, you know, it's a murky world out there, but it's kind of easy. Don't touch people. Yeah. Don't touch people you're working with and control yourself.
Right. Well, and if you want to know how this kind of harassment can actually affect people for years, and it doesn't necessarily have to be just touching. Okay. Read what Ellen Page had to say about how Brett Ratner treated her the very first day on the set of X-Men: The Last Stand. She was 18 years old.
She was 18. Yeah.
Yeah, and she had not come out as gay.
And to herself.
To herself, even. She didn't really know what was going on with herself because she's 18, maybe. And he basically said, "Hey, will somebody kiss you?" Know.
No. He was far cruder.
Yeah.
Far cruder, and it's at the meet and greet where you're all sitting around the table the first day to get together, and this 18-year-old kid who's not a famous person, and he just is incredibly crude, says she's a lesbian and somebody should F her just to let her realize that. I mean, you just say, oh my God, that's the first day on the set. What a hateful pig. And then she talks about, in a really thoughtful piece, she was propositioned at 16 by a director who put his hand on her knee, Tina Brown, and said, you have to make the first move. Another director asked her to have sex with a friend in his 20s and tell him about it when she was 16 years old. And I keep going back to the story of Alex Winter from Bill and Ted, who says he was sexually assaulted as a kid, or maybe raped. I forget what his terminology was, but he said it happened all the time. And if you're a kid in the entertainment world, in any area, music, movies, TV, whatever, it's not safe. It's not a safe space. And we may be sick of these stories, but that's just got to be unacceptable.
Well, and you mentioned something about Tina Brown, Michael, which might confuse our listeners. Tina Brown was the, well, she started at the Tatler in the UK when she was very young. She moved to the United States before the age of 30 and became the editor of Vanity Fair. She then took over The New Yorker. She then worked with Harvey Weinstein on a magazine
called
Talk.
She destroyed The New Yorker. Yeah.
Well, okay. David Remnick then took it over.
Absolutely.
So she's kind of a media person. And we were, both Michael and I were talking about an interview she did with David Remnick of The New Yorker regarding her new book, that's, I guess, being published now. So that's what that was about.
Well, not so she was asked, I talked over you. She worked with Harvey Weinstein on a magazine that they launched together with, was it Adam Moss or who was it?
I don't remember.
No, it wasn't Adam Moss. It was, I forget. But it was a weekly. I actually fact checked one or two articles for them once briefly. So I actually have a connection to that magazine. But she was basically talking about Harvey and talking about saying how you shouldn't lump in people who just behave a little inappropriately with the rapists. She said, you know, he put his arm, she's speaking theoretically, he put his hand on her knee in 1984. Let's not compare that to a rapist. And it's like, well, no, you don't have to, but that's wrong too.
Right.
Your boss should not put their hand on your knee. And I was sort of scoffing at Tina Brown.
What I will say is that I talked to a couple of writers. These are television writers, both men and women. And the man said, look, was more very matter of fact about it. The two men actually said they both separately, in separate conversations, said, you know, what's going to wind up happening is the writer's room I work in now, well, they'll all be just men, or they'll be just women, or, you know, agents won't feel comfortable sending a guy to a writer's room that's predominantly women. And so that writer's room will become all women.
And, well, that's insane.
And the woman said, you know, what's going to happen is I'm not going to get opportunities in writers' rooms that are predominantly men, and these male-driven writers' rooms will probably not hire me.
Right, which is insane. We can't be around women if we can't harass, assault, and rape them. That is what you're saying. That is what they're saying. It just won't work. We can't, what are you going to do? Or they're saying, we can't trust them not to accuse us. So we got to watch our P's and Q's. It's kind of simple. Don't grab their breasts. Don't grab their ass. Don't hit on them. Don't assault them. Don't pressure them to have sex with you in order to advance their career. It's not difficult. You, Sperling, have never grabbed a woman's ass in a professional setting. You've never grabbed their knee. You've never asked them for sex. You've never asked them out on dates. You've behaved professionally and normally like any decent human being. It's not that hard.
Hold on, I'm writing all those down. What was that third one?
Exactly. Yeah, but that's lunacy. And I talked to you about the sports world. There's a UK golf coach who's, you know, famous. He has golf schools all over the UK. He coaches a lot of professional golfers who've gone on to great fame. And he said in this asinine story, well, I won't take female clients because what if I dump them and decide I don't want to work with them anymore and they're going to want revenge and they're with all this crazy political correctness around, they'll accuse me of rape and everyone will believe them and my life will be over. In other words, you can't trust women. If I can't assault them, I certainly can't trust them to be around me because they might just accuse me of it even though I haven't done it. So we'll have to get rid of all women. Well, genius. Guess what? There's more of them than you.
Well, I wonder what gossip columnist Liz Smith would have made of all this if these accusations and these stories started to be revealed during her time as a gossip columnist.
Well, she was pretty retro, so I think she probably would have been a little too old school like Tina Brown, like, oh, suck it up. We've had to deal with this and da-da-da, and probably failed to recognize and realize, yeah, you know what? That was wrong all those years. You shouldn't have to put up with that. But it'd be interesting to know, but unfortunately, she's gone now. She died at the age of 94, didn't she?
Yes.
And the gossip column, as she knew it, died about 15 years earlier. So that's, she really is the last of an era. There's lots of people who die every week, like John Hillerman from Magnum PI and all those Peter Bogdanovich movies. We kind of like to save people that we have something to say or really symbolize something. And Liz Smith does. It's the end of the gossip columnist. There's still gossip. There's still tons of sites like TMZ, but she really is the end of an era. She came in the wake of Hollywood legends like Luella Parsons. She was more of a champion and a safe space for celebs she liked. She was really like Ed Sullivan in a way. And she was closeted for many years, so I'm sure she valued people's privacy. Though ultimately, she came out and was outed and would say, well, I'm bisexual. That's sort of as far as she could go. But she didn't dish dirt so much as just trade on her relationships to get items in her column. She was friends with Liz Taylor and Richard Burton. She sided with Ivana Trump against Donald Trump. He's like the only celeb who hates her. Like, she was friends with everybody. Like, even if she wasn't your friend, she was not your enemy. That was true of everyone from Liz Taylor to Lindsay Lohan, except for Donald Trump. So you see who your enemies are. That shows you have good taste.
So basically, Kim Jong-un and Liz Smith.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, dear God, she worked at Modern Screen Magazine. She arrived in New York in 1949. She began her column at the Daily News in 1976. Then she went to Newsday, finally The Post, and of course Page Six. And she was fired in 2009 at the age of 86. And I have to say, my grandmother did her one better. My grandma was, quote unquote, retired by the Globe and Mail at the age of 89.
Oh,
wasn't
wow.
A gossip columnist, but yeah, she worked there until she was 89 years old. So great long career. Cool for her.
So basically she was like kind of like, I guess Perez Hilton kind of took over for her in the modern world.
Well, I don't really read him. Is he mostly about just championing people he likes? Is he not about dishing nasty negative dirt?
Okay, then I take it all back.
All right. That's her thing.
What I can take back is the last, hour plus that you just listened to our podcast. So thank you very much. You know, you can subscribe to our podcast in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to the show. You can rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators, and we do appreciate it when you do that. You can find that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
It's justdon'tbeajerk.com.
Well, that's actually probably not a true domain. So if you want to read some of Michael's writing about the entertainment industry, head on over to the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out BookFilter at bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.